Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is Chris. Welcome to episode 43 of NML Crossing, where we're wrapping up another one of them busy weekends here at the house, but a good kind of busy. It's not like last weekend where everything almost fell apart. This weekend was busy, but for all the right reasons here. We're making moves here. We're putting things in order, and soon this house situation will be behind us completely. So with that said, I do want to just, before we get into it here, just say that these next few weeks might be spotty. Now, I know my track record over the past, 18 months, 2 years has not been stellar. But I just want to assure you that if I miss a day or miss 2 days, that I haven't disappeared. If this were a year ago and I didn't post for a day or two, I could almost guarantee you that I did disappear. So it's different this year. It's just a matter of having the time. I'm usually one of the least busy people you'll ever want to meet, but not right now. So anyway, with that warning out of the way, let's get into today's book here. We're wrapping up our look at the flagship's Road to No Man's Land today. For better or for worse, this is Batman number 562, which had a February 1999 cover date. Story is called Bruce Wayne Goes to Washington Part 3, The Devil His Due. Written by Chuck Dixon with pencils by Jim Aparo. Inks David Roach, letters Todd Klein, colors Lee Lowridge, or Lowridge, edits Gorfinkel O'Neill, cover price $1.99. Now this, if I'm not mistaken, this is going to be the last time we see Bruce for a little while here on the show. Not to put the, not to spoil anything here, I have read a little bit ahead I wanted to get ahead on my scripting since, like I said, we're going to be intermittently busy, so I wanted to make sure I had scripts ready to go. And so I've read the next arc here, the Detective Comics arc. I already read that and scripted it, and I had the extreme pleasure of reading No Man's Land number one, which I cannot wait to talk about that. It was a long time coming, and if everything goes according to plan, we will be in No Man's Land by the end of this week. And like I said, can't wait to share that, can't wait to discuss it, can't wait to hear what everybody else thinks about it as well, because it's a tonal shift, the likes of which we don't see in comics very often. And it's going to be fun. It's going to be fun to navigate. But with that said, let's finish up Bruce's story for now. We open with the news of the verdict that's just gone down on Capitol Hill. That being, Gotham City is being shut down, and her citizens are going to be given a 48-hour window to get the F out or be trapped there forever. As such, Gothamites are leaving by the million. They're crossing over soon-to-be-blown-up bridges to find their new homes. Now, the governor of whatever state Gotham City is in has ordered the National Guard to stand down and leave, with the evacuation being left in the hands of the U.S. Marshals. Now, the Marshals, they're doing that whole, like, papers please thing for anybody attempting to cross the bridges, because, felons have been excluded from the order. You see, they're stuck in Gotham whether they like it or not. We see Killer Croc, or at least I assume it's Killer Croc, it's a reptilian green guy. He's trying to sneak across the bridge, only to be stopped by the feds. Now he dives into the drink below to try his luck making a water exit. We hop over to Babs' black and white TV, where a newscaster who appears to be stood before the Nerf logo is chatting up reporter Tara Schoenstein-Jimenez, who is live on the scene. You remember, was that like a thing in the 90s? I remember, there was a newscaster on Married with Children who had, like, a really long hyphenated name, and it always got a laugh for some reason, so I wonder if that's a play on that there. Anyway, she reports that the evac perhaps isn't quite as peaceful as it could be, and, there have been shots fired. They then send it over to important things like sports, where the Bloodhaven Bloodhounds have trounced the Keystone City Patriots, just in case you were interested or maybe had some money running on that one. Barbara Gordon is, in fact, not interested, and so she hurls her coffee mug through the television set that she likely bought at a yard sale 20 years earlier. We hop over to Washington, D.C., where one of Mayor Grange's aides, this woman with a gigantic bun in her hair, she's trying to find Bruce Wayne. She finds him in his ransacked hotel room, which, you know, stands to reason, even though after his performance during the trial, he really only has himself to blame for being very tone-deaf. Moments later, Bruce meets with the mayor, who reveals this whole evac thing is predicated by a long-forgotten loophole regarding national security, one that may or may not be constitutional. But, well, the constitutionality really doesn't help them at present, since the verdict's been laid down and Gotham City is being cut off from the rest of the United States. Now, this order, evidently, came from the White House itself, so it looks like everything up to this point has been rendered moot. Like, there really never was a debate. We talked about how this entire trial was for show, and, well, this pretty much proves it. From here, we zip back to Gotham City, where Commissioner Gordon and Sarah Essen are meeting with a police medical examiner who's got a room full of bodies. Bodies that have been genetically altered to have strange muscle groupings, weird organs, and altered brain structures. They are Nicholas Scratch's devil heads. And, you know, I think I owe whoever created it. I guess I owe Denny and Chuck an apology here, because we find out that those devil heads aren't masks. These goofballs actually look like that. So I guess that sort of kind of lampshades the fact that they never seem to take them off. Now, apparently, these devil heads have been tasked with killing Commissioner Gordon, which isn't a story we've seen yet. I have here in my script, maybe we'll see it play out in the Detective 3-parter we'll start next episode. And yes, we will see it there. Anyway, Colleen, the medical examiner, suggests that whoever it is that wants Gordon dead is anything but a common criminal. This person's capable of creating monsters. Now, Gordon says the fight ain't over yet, and he demands the devil-headed corpses be burned as he rushes out of the place. Now, this shifts us over to Nicholas J. Scratch, who's getting word from Devilhead Pazuzu that they failed in their mission to kill Jim Gordon. Gotta say, these devilheads are perhaps the worst flunkies ever. Have they succeeded in a single thing yet? Except, like, looking stupid? No, they haven't. Now, Scratch says he's not concerned, and that he's hired a professional to take out his, quote, prime target. Now, next thing we know, a female assassin with a gigantic bun in her hair, just like the other lady, is headed into a Washington, D.C. hotel where she gets herself into position. And we can see that Bruce Wayne is her target. She's got pictures of him in her briefcase. Meanwhile, Bruce and the mayor leave. Maybe the same hotel? Maybe one across the street? Whatever the case, it's within the sights of this assassin. And they're headed back to the Capitol, or wherever the trial was. And they're being led to an Alfred-driven limousine. Now you see, Grange has convinced Bruce to sit in on the congressional session, which seals Gotham City's fate. He's not too keen on it, but he's begrudgingly willing to play along. Grange says that even something as bad as this can be valuable politically. Now, as they're about to get into the limo, the assassin is startled by a cleaning woman. She freaks out and pulls the trigger, so she's a really bad assassin. Anybody who works for Nick Scratch absolutely sucks. He's got to improve his vetting process. So she pulls the trigger, and as mentioned, she is just as inept as any number of devil heads here. She takes her eyes off the prize and winds up shooting Mayor Grange right between her shoulder blades. Bruce catches the mayor and notes the smoke from the shot is coming from a fourth-story window. He instinctively goes to Batman up, but he's stopped by Alfred, because this is about Gotham and not a dead mayor or something. I don't get it here, but Bruce seems to. And he calls Alfred a treasure while Mayor Grange bleeds out on the street. It's like a very surreal scene here. It's also a very stupid-looking scene. It's like Bruce just standing there over a woman bleeding out. Okay. Now, the assassin manages to escape, by the way, in case you were interested. We turn the page, and we're watching Nick Scratch's black and white television, because they all have black and white TVs, and it's here we learn that Mayor Grange did not survive. Scratch, he's not pleased. A dead political hack does him zero good. He was banking on the pretty billionaire getting a bullet in the dome. Nick Scratch sucks. Oh, he sucks. Now, Pazuzu volunteers to kill Bruce Wayne, which would be completely adorable if only Scratch didn't give him the thumbs up. I mean, how many failures is Nick gonna allow? This is ridiculous. This is like bordering on parody. Anyway, we head back to Gotham City, where Lucius Fox and some woman named Karen Abrams are boarding a Wayne Corp chopper to get the F out of the city. As they fly over the harbor, we see some bridges being exploded, and in the distance, we see some folks watching the bridges go down. And those people are the Arkham crew, led by the Joker. And he's got along with him for the ride Mr. Zazz, Scarecrow, Riddler, the Quake Master, Two-Face, Maxi Zeus, and Poison Ivy. All of whom have the biggest chuckle-headed smiles on their face. Well, that's not exactly true. Two-Face has half a chuckle-headed smile on his face, and the Quake Master, he never smiles, so he might still be dealing with laxative issues from, you know, his last few days at Arkham, for all we know. From here, we head over to the Clock Tower, where Robin is mourning the fall of Gotham City. Nightwing wishes that he could be of more help, but, well, he's gonna have his hands full, you know, more than full, with Bloodhaven. He suggests that the population is going to double over the next few days. Now, Tim says his dad is thinking about moving to Keystone City, to which I hope he's already left since the bridge has already been blown up. Tim will be relocating to Keystone. Now, Babs says that she's staying. Dick's not happy to hear that, but she's adamant that she ain't going anywhere. Elsewhere, Cobra Commander is fomenting some sort of movement among the remaining Gothamites while prancing around a hobo fire. He says they're going to escape to Chalfont and gets a raucous bit of applause. I have no idea what this is all about. Maybe we'll find out later. We jump back to Nick Scratch, who looks like he's wearing a prison jumpsuit here. Did we miss an issue where he was put under house? I don't know. Pazuzu calls in. You see, he's been sitting outside the Capitol for hours and has not seen any sign of Bruce Wayne. Nick Scratch, he's not keen on this news, so he destroys his phone in a rage. He just smashes his phone. We close out with a news report from the Trigate Bridge, which is apparently the last remaining artery into or out of Gotham City. And I think over the next few episodes, we're going to see like three or four different bridges that are all called the last road out. And they were all written by Chuck Dixon, so I don't know. Anyway, in 30 minutes, it'll be going down like the rest. The anchor reveals that Congress is just about to make everything official, you know, cross the T's, dot the I's, and notes that Bruce Wayne is not present nor accounted for at the hearing. Worth noting, he's being referred to here as, quote, Gotham's first citizen. You know, a real man of the people. That is it. That's where we leave it. Next time out, we're going to kick off our final Road to No Man's Land arc in Detective Comics number 727. Now, this issue does not have a letters page, which is unfortunate. I was kind of hoping that this issue would have a letters page just to kind of usher us into the next phase of things. This is the last issue of the flagship before we're full-blown No Man's Land for a year. So it would have been neat to have a little so long farewell, thanks for the memory sort of thing. But nope, we don't get that here. Instead, we just have ads. And that's where we leave it. So what do we think? What do we think about this one? Like I've been saying the past couple of episodes here, this Bruce Wayne Goes to Washington arc was one that I was looking forward to since we started the program here, and even before that, when I would have a wild hair to just read this for fun, or just on my own time. This arc was something I was excited for because I thought it was going to be more than what it was. Instead, what we get is like very hastily thrown together stuff here. Like, while stuff actually happens, none of it really feels like it matters. Like, it feels like we're rushing through stuff that, you know, it's like we're going down a to-do list. You know, we need these things done. Whether or not the road to get there is entertaining is immaterial. And I don't know, I was just really let down by this, which is unfortunate. Really unfortunate. I suppose the silver lining is just the fact that it's over. I mean, I didn't hate it. It was just disappointing. It was a disappointment, which I may, that might be worse than not liking it. And, you know, I've been talking a lot about, we've all been talking a lot, actually, about how awful Nick Scratch is. I can't believe he loomed this large. And he's someone that, before starting this show, I never heard of before. And I could have lived the rest of my days not having known of Nicholas Scratch, the man of the century, and I'd have been just fine. But I can't believe that he was so present in this and actually kind of had a say in whether or not Gotham City was gonna... Maybe he did. Maybe he didn't. Maybe he's just a distraction. Maybe he's just a show. But I don't know. I just can't believe that he was so involved and had so much focus and is just... And it's like on so many different levels here. He's like, publicly, he's anti-Gotham, but he also has this like underground anti-Gotham thing to him too. Just so very bizarre. It kind of reminds me of how like Bane showed up like right before Nightfall and turned out to be the one to take Batman out after, you know, all the time with all of Batman's villains and enemies and rogues, right? And just this new guy comes in, walks on in, and breaks him. Here we have, yeah, we have all the Arkham residents, the Blackgate residents. We got all the bad guys. And it's Nicholas Scratch that just saunters in and is kind of this like weird linchpin to get us into no man's land. Who knows? Who knows? I wish I had more to say about this, but I don't. Nick Scratch hires the worst people who can't do anything right. We're going to see more of that in the upcoming Detective three-parter. It's going to be a comedy of errors for the Nick Scratch crew. It's going to be ridiculous. Not great. And, you know, I just don't have much more to say. Of course, I'd love to hear you guys' thoughts. I just don't want to keep relitigating the same points, and I don't want to be overly negative. I'll just end this with this three-parter was a disappointment. It just wasn't what I wanted it to be. The Detective Comics three-parter will be better. It's still not going to be great. So we will weather that, and in 4 episodes' time, we will be in no man's land. And like I said at the start of the show, I can't wait. That's going to be a lot of fun to discuss. But with all that said here, how about we hop into the NML bag before we cut out? We're going to start with Chris Yu, who's talking about the Shadow of the Bat three-parter that we discussed. And he says, I'm surprised to see the Nicholas Scratch plot from Azrael mentioned here, since I have no memory of this character existing. Since we had some mention of Bruce Wayne testifying in DC in part 3 of the Azrael story, which is 2 months away from this issue in the publishing schedule, I'm wondering how tightly the road to No Man's Land was plotted among the various Bat books. This issue was a good first part to the last Alan Grant Shadow of the Bat story. And yes, that three-part Shadow story was great. That was a lot of fun. Alan Grant, I mean, I've probably gushed too much about Alan Grant because I'm not terribly familiar with his work outside of Shadow of the Bat and, you know, some of his earlier Bat stuff post-Crisis. Outside of that, I really don't know much about what I'm pretty sure he has some 2000 AD stuff, but my knowledge of 2000 AD is spotty at best, and spotty would be probably overselling how much experience I have reading those. But I just love that I'm not the only one here who has absolutely no memory of Nick Scratch. Now, as for how tightly these were plotted, I really don't know. Like I said, discussing this this Bruce Wayne Goes to Washington bit, it feels kind of rushed, feels kind of slapped together, feels like they were going down a checklist. I don't know if there was like a hard start date for No Man's Land proper that they had to just get all the pieces in place for, or what. But there was, outside of the Shadow three-parter, there was definitely a step backwards in, at least in my opinion, it was a step backwards in quality among the other books involved. The three issues of Azrael, the three issues of Batman, and the three issues of Detective were yet to discuss. Definitely, they don't hit the same. Now, I am behind in covering the Wizard stuff. You know, I've been trying to fit in Wizard stuff wherever I can here. The past couple of weeks have been a little bit of a nightmare, so I haven't had the chance to sit down with them. But before I pack them up, I do want to go through a few of them and make sure that I chat them up here, and maybe we'll get some insight. Since it is the late 90s DC, and it isn't JLA or Vertigo, I'm assuming Wizard's not going to cover it too much. But hopefully there's something. Hopefully there's something. Maybe it'll be an interview. Maybe it'll be a news feed or news bit. News bite. Yeah, news bite, I think, is the right word. Maybe we'll see in their thumbs up, thumbs down thing. Maybe they'll make fun of Nicholas Scratch and we can all have a good laugh at Nick Scratch's expense. But look forward to that in the coming episodes here. Hopefully I'll find a way to squeeze that in. But thank you so much for writing in, Chris, and also for making me feel less insane for never having known or heard of Nicholas Scratch. Next up, our friend Jason chatting up Catwoman number 57. And he says, I chuckled as I read this issue, as I knew you would not be at all pleased by the mushroom bit. It's Dr. Nemesis from Way of X or Legion of X all over again. And this one made me chuckle as well. Now, if you recall, we had that issue of Catwoman where she ran into Poison Ivy, and Poison Ivy kissed the dude, and the like mushrooms started growing out of his eyes and his ears and his skin. It was just, it really skeeved me out. Mushrooms gross me out. I mean, they're disgusting. Fungus and ugh. I don't know how I got through playing Last of Us, because mushrooms are just, oh, they are the most vile things. I'm sure there's worse things, but they are just so disgusting. And over on X-Lapsed, when we were covering the Way of X and Legion of X, Dr. Nemesis would wear his like weird little fedora, right? But when he took it off, his entire head was covered in mushrooms. Oh my god, it like, thank goodness that like Way of X was drawn like more cartoony, because if that was realistic, I'd have vomited. I'm sure of it. It's just really gross. And then thankfully Catwoman was also, you know, more cartoony than realistic, because that ain't something I want to see. But thank you for writing in, Jason. Thank you for listening, and thank you for the laugh, because you know my pain when I see fungi. Ugh. Anyway, next up, we got a letter from our friend Chris Bailey here, and he says, hey brother, I'm catching up on the show. Got to talk about collecting. The storage conversation on long boxes and bagging preference are great talking points. I am a classic bagger. It's always the classic fold and two pieces of tape on each side. As for long boxes, I agree the longer the box, the easier it is to maintain continuity of the franchise category. Some boxes get pretty lonely, though, as there's only so much space you need for such fare as The Ray? On The Ray, as you alluded to books like The Ray, there's selections we have in our collections that we look back and wonder what we were thinking. I mean, can you recall one single story featuring The Ray? I have a question for the listeners. What is that series in your collection that you consider your very own version of The Ray? And that is an awesome question. I can't wait to hear some answers on that, because I always talk about how relatable all of our comic collecting experiences are, because they are, right? They're very unique to what we do and what we're interested in and what we love. But, like, we all have that in us where, like, if you come across a full run of something or an extended run of something, it's like you almost need to pick it up, right? And I mentioned the Ray, and somehow I have an entire run of, like, the 90s Ray series. And I don't know why, because I don't think I've read a single issue of it. I think about things like, I think I mentioned El Diablo, the Gerard Jones thing from, I want to say late 80s. It was like a DC's new format book. And I have zero interest in that. None. And I tried reading it before all the Gerard Jones things came up, but I couldn't get through it. It was just so dull. And but the fact that I was able to find all of them like in a quarter bin, it was like, okay, I kind of have to pick that up. Think about the two long boxes of Legion comics I have. I mean, one of the things people know about me is that I don't understand Legion fandom at all. And I have two entire long boxes of Legion comics. Why? I just do. And it's crazy to think about, because I'll probably never read any of them. I'm trying to go through. I have my little key to my long boxes here, and I'm flipping through it. So if you hear paper rustling, that's what it is. The John Byrne New Gods thing, the Jack Kirby's Fourth World books. Why do I own those? I have no interest in that. Oh, the 1990s Fate series. So yeah, I guess regrets, I have a few. Bailey continues, if I think back, I often wonder how I ended up with so many Eternal Warriors in my collection. Along with the Ray, I swear the Eternal Warrior ends up everywhere. That's another question I want to ask here. I don't know if I have already. It might not have been on this show. But for anybody out there who does go through those dollar bins and the 50-cent bins, are there any books that are just ubiquitous? No matter what bin you're in, you're going to find multiple copies of it. And I mean, we can use the Youngblood scale, because, you know, it's like, that's kind of the go-to. It's like, oh yeah, Youngblood number one will be in every 50-cent bin you come across here. But I want deeper cuts on that. Maybe things will be region-specific. For me, the one I see is, I wish I remember the number off the top of my head, but it's an issue of Action Comics shortly after The Death of Superman wraps up. And it's the cover is Clark Kent with his longer hair, like, tearing open his shirt with the Superman costume or uniform underneath it. I actually stopped to look it up here. It's Action Comics 692. This book is in every single 50-cent bin I ever come across. I mean, it's not an indictment on the quality of the issue, but it's just one that I always see. It's I don't know, it's just, I don't know why it's always there. I'm guessing it's speculation related, probably, but you tell me, is that Arizona specific, or is that nationwide? You tell me. Back to Bailey, he says, on podcasting tips, I recalled that podcasting episode from back in the day. I think plenty of it still applies. I think two of the biggest takeaways are managing expectations. Starting out, you're not starting out with the same privilege that established shows have with a built-in audience and reach. A beginner can expect to be talking to themselves. Maybe their mom, their dad, or their best friend will tune in to episodes 1 and 2 if you're lucky. I remember my first blog post on WordPress. I'm not sure I expected the utter silence I received. The only clicks I received at first were from me refreshing or just checking on my page. And, yeah, that is, that's me right there. When I first started any blog, it's because it's like you, the expectation is weird, right? Because anybody can access the internet, right? Anybody can find whatever they want to find on the internet. But when you actually put something out, you almost expect that people are going to find it. Like, it's like this weird small world syndrome. Like, you think, like, the internet's very small. Like, oh, if someone wants to hear about Teen Titans number 55 or Tales of the Titans number 55, they'll obviously find me. No, that's not the case at all. And I remember how disappointed I was when I realized that, because I started on Blogger or Blogspot, or whatever we called it, and there was a way to turn off your views. Like, so anytime you went to your site, it wouldn't register as a view. And I remember discovering that like 2 or 3 days into blogging, and I was so disappointed because my numbers went down so far because I was the only idiot clicking on this stuff. So it's like you go from, four views to one. It's and it's sad. It really is. It reminds me of back when I was trying to do the indie comic thing back in the day. I was working with a buddy of mine who set up a website for the comics that we were gonna do, and I remember him. He had like a little notepad next to his computer, where every time he would check the site, he would put a hash mark on the pad. So when he looked at the stats, he would have to like manually subtract all the times he looked at it, because you got to get the, I guess, the right impression of how many people are seeing your stuff. But it's so true that when you start out, it's easy to get like delusional and think like, oh, this is something people are gonna dig here. They don't know who I am from a hole in the wall, but they'll find it. And maybe back in mid late 90s that was truer, but nowadays, nah, everybody's got a, well, I was gonna say everybody's got a blog. Nobody's got blogs anymore. Everybody's got a podcast or a YouTube channel now, but the point still stands, I guess. Chris continues. I remember that on my fourth post, I went Chris viral. I got me over 100 views on a Saturday morning cartoon post and even got comments and a couple of shares. I had arrived. And then the next post tanked, but the one after that jumped back up. It was maddening. I could see the addiction cycle beginning, so I slowed down. I checked myself and I went back to having fun. For content I consume, I think consistency is the trick for me as a listener and super casual podcaster. Shows I like have a reliable structure and flow to the shows that I already listen to. It's a familiarity that I enjoy. I don't have to think about it. I know what to expect, and there's a security that I'm not wasting my time. The other thing is evergreen content. One weakness of being current and timely is that the content has a timer on it. It's in the moment and not retrospective. I consider that disposable content, stuff that I can listen to at any time with the blessing of hindsight and insight. And that, I actually bolded the word evergreen here in the script here because that was a crisis I went through last year, like when I stopped with X-Lapsed. X-Lapsed was a different sort of project because it wasn't evergreen. Right. I think I even posted something on the blog called like From Evergreen to Ephemeral. Because when you're doing stuff in the moment, when you're doing stuff that's current, it's ephemeral. It's only important now. Like we talked about with those ratioed variant covers, like they're only a big deal now because next week there's going to be a whole bunch more of them. So if I'm talking about whatever X-Men book came out a week ago, that's got a timer on it, like Bailey says here. But, if somebody really wants to know what's happening, they can find it anywhere. Add to the fact that I did ephemeral wrong because I've got like this weird sense of, I don't know, a decorum to me where like I'm never going to be the 12:01 a.m. Wednesday spoiler guy. I hate that. I think that just that takes so much of the enjoyment out of this hobby, and it ruins things. It spoils things in every definition of the word, right? So I'm never going to be that 12:01 a.m. guy. Hell, I wasn't even like the same week guy. In a lot of cases, I wasn't even the same month guy. I like giving people the time to read the books that were coming out. I didn't want to be someone who spoiled things. I feel like that's cheating, I want people to tune in to whatever show or blog or whatever the hell I'm doing because they want to, not because like they need the information right now and it doesn't matter who delivers it. I like having our little, you know, our little community here and our conversations, and I don't know, I like that we can discuss things without resorting to bait, you know, like spoiling things, ruining things for people. So that was my dilemma there, because I was ephemeral because I was working with current stuff, but I was doing it wrong. I wasn't profiting, or not profiting, I wasn't benefiting from doing it as quickly as I could have, you know? So in a lot of ways, XLapsed became like double disposable. You know, not only was it stuff that's only, you know, kind of newsworthy now, it wasn't even newsworthy when I was talking about it. It was like already, it was already old news. We were on to the next thing, and I don't know, it just didn't really work. And I mean, that was a hard shift to make, because back with the you know, with the Cosmic Treadmill and Weird Comics History, we endeavored to be evergreen. And I think you could probably listen to probably 90% of what Reggie and I did, and it would still be as whatever today as it was then, you know? You'd still get just as much out of it, which, you know, that was kind of soul crushing for me, because like I'll sometimes get a wild hair to go back and listen to something Reggie and I did together. You know, I'll, you know, something will pop into my head. It's like, oh, I want to listen to that again. I don't get that with XLapsed at all. You know, XLapsed, I could put on, we did 370 episodes of that. I mean, I could put on any one of them right now and not, it would just, it wouldn't matter. You know, it's just, it's that disposable. That's unfortunate to say, since I spent thousands of hours on it. But it's worthless. It's, you know, nobody's going to be looking for that. Nobody's going to be like, oh, I wonder what this idiot thinks about Marauders number 9. That's never going to happen. You know, and I say this as I'm doing an issue by issue look at No Man's Land here. So is someone in 3 years' time going to say, I really want to know what this idiot thinks about Asriel number 46 or 47? It's like, no, that's probably not going to happen. But since this is an older story, I feel like it is a little bit more evergreen than what we were doing with XLapsed. Back to Bailey. He says, this leads me to Action Comics Weekly. That was your best solo blogging work, period. As a friend, I recall many conversations of the joys and frustrations around those posts. I remember telling you how important what you were doing was. I remember your frustration at the dips in engagement, but I knew you were creating an indispensable library of evergreen content. You created a resource. I love that you look back and see it for what it always was. It was your magnum blogging opus, and I'm proud of you for doing that work. And that really does mean a lot. Because Action Comics Weekly, he put it perfectly here, joy and frustration. I loved the fact that I was doing something that no one else had ever done before, at least as far as I know. Going through the entirety of these weird stories. You know, we got to talk about Malvolio. I mean, it was so much fun. But at the same time, it was like, it was a grind that, like, I bled readers. I bled readers. It was hard for me to stomach. It was hard for me to take, especially, you know, like I talked about a little bit ago with the delusions of reach, right? You start a new blog and you just expect people to find it, and they don't. They don't. But I was delusional in other ways, because I felt like I'd been doing it for so long that I almost deserved an audience, which is a bad place to be. It's a really bad, really, really out to lunch take to have, because nobody owes you anything. Nobody owes me anything, especially. So when you get into your own head like that, and because by the time we started Action Comics Weekly, I had been doing the blog every single day for 3 years? 17, 18, 19, yeah, 3 years. So 3 years of daily blogging. I mean, my posts were usually 2,000 words. So, I mean, they weren't skimped, you know, they weren't skimpy, shrimpy posts. They were fully fleshed out synopsises and discussions and analyses and all that kind of stuff. So when I went to Action Comics Weekly, you know, the each post was shorter because I mean these were anthology stories. They were 8 to 12 pages. One of the days was just Superman, a 2-page Superman story. So we creep, from a niche to a niche to a niche to a niche, right? And I expected to have the same sort of numbers before and after, and it just wasn't the case. And I became very jaded and very cynical and very angry. And I tried to hide it as best I could, but I'm sure my petulance came to the surface every now and again. And I do regret and apologize that if I ever came across as flip or as just not appreciating what I had, which what I had was some wonderfully loyal readers who engaged and chatted me up and were along for the ride, and that really meant the world to me. And I just couldn't see it because it was different, it was less in numbers, and the numbers are always going to be. I wish I didn't see my numbers now, because I still kind of get hooked, like hung up on them on occasion. I try not to look at them. I try not to even, like, if there were a way I could shut them off, I would, because that's not what it's about. What it's about is, I mean, we're talking about comics, and we're talking about life as a comic fan and a comic collector and a hobbyist and an enthusiast, and that's what I love. I always say that whenever I do something, I'm in search of one. I'm in search of the one person that's gonna get it, that's gonna love this, that's gonna have the same experience as me, or have a a contrasting experience to me, but someone who will enjoy this silliness that I engage in. Back to Bale here. He says, "Sometimes, as you said, content creation is a very lonely game, and I have a different experience than you in many regards because I never allowed myself to stick to one topic. I always, whether blogging or solo podcasting, loved variety. I never enjoyed making things out of obligation. When my hobby things became work, I stopped doing them rather quickly. I try and keep motivated with stuff that I like. That's why stats and numbers never worried me. I do it for my enjoyment first. It's selfish, but sustainable." I love that. That sentence right there is powerful. Selfish, but sustainable. Because when you're doing this, I mean, I think I mentioned this not too long ago, but I was looking through old posts on Chris's on Infinite Earths when I could truly see that I was enjoying myself, and when I could actually see that the person writing these posts was like beaming with energy and passion, I enjoyed reading it more. I enjoyed revisiting it more. So I would have to assume that people reading it along with me would enjoy those more than just some grumpy guy complaining that nobody likes his stuff, or that nobody's gonna read, nobody's gonna tweet, nobody's gonna do this, nobody's gonna do that. Nobody wants to hear that crap, you know? So selfish but sustainable is perfect because you're serving yourself first, which means you're going to be happy, right? Happiness is contagious. If people read the words of a happy person, I think they're going to enjoy it a lot more than, I mean, of course, there's bait in anger, but not depression and cynicism, really. Because there are some posts on that site that are, I guess, navel-gazing would be putting it lightly. But if I were to go back to a post, Teen Titans, Total Chaos, I had so much fun covering Total Chaos. More fun than I ever expected to. I could tell in rereading that and revisiting that I was passionate and that I was just having so much fun with the silliness and just, I don't know, just it just felt right, So I think that's one bit of advice that I left out of my idiot's guide there. Be selfish. Do for you because it will shine through, and it will sustain you. It'll keep you motivated. It'll keep you going. It'll keep you excited. Because once that spark goes out, it's hard to get it back. And I can say that from experience here, because I disappeared for a couple of years, you know? When that spark goes out, it's gone. And when you're talking about a hobby here, and I've mentioned this before, but like I don't know how to divorce what I do here in front of a microphone with reading comics. Like, it's hard for me to separate the two now. So it's like almost like I poisoned the chalice, you know? So it's for anybody who might be listening, looking for advice on content creation. Mr. Bailey put it perfectly here. Be selfish, because it's sustainable. Bailey continues. It does, however, feel great when it connects you with others. So here's my compliment for you. You mentioned our show, Moratory Mondays, and the good times around that show in general. I just stated that I don't stick with things unless I'm having fun. Guess what? We went 30-plus episodes, and it's the content that I'm most proud of. I had the dubious distinction of becoming your podcast partner after Reggie passed, and that alone is pressure to deliver. I didn't worry because I had the guy who knew podcasting better than anyone I knew. Wow. thank you. Moratory Mondays was a blast. Those were some really good times. And to say that I missed them would be very much an understatement. Those were great. Those were great. And not only did you have the distinction of being my partner after Reggie, you were also, you don't know this, but you actually filled a lot of the roles that Reggie filled for me. You know, we just talked about the numbers and how I would stress over that crap, like as though my life depended on it. And Reggie would cool me down. And with Moratory, you cooled me down. With people cribbing our work, you know, like I mentioned during the Idiot's Guide, I've listened to shows where people are literally reading my script back to me without any credit, without any nod, without anything like that. And I mean, I don't mind. We talked about just now Action Comics Weekly being a resource. I love that idea. I love the idea of being a resource that people can come to and get information, even if it's just like getting dates or getting creative teams or whatever. Just, but it's like, tip the hat, you know, do a little tip of the hat. So my hair would go on fire in those situations, and Reggie would calm me down. And with Moratory, well, that fell to you. So, just more evidence that Moratory Mondays was magic. back to Chris here. He says, you knew how to piece things together and Frankenstein a good show out of our bloopers and hot takes. You made it easy, comfortable, and just fun. We became real friends who went through stuff together. We laughed, cried, raged, you name it. And I treasured it all, and we did it. As a slice of the behind the curtain, I remember the joy of the call that I gave you when we landed Brent Anderson to be on our little show. For a minute in the world, what we did for 30-plus weeks was legitimized. That was electric and massively fulfilling. And if I'm bragging, who cares, because we nailed that interview. Brother, it was a real pleasure, and if I never did a podcast again, I can look back and sit at that run and say, look, kids, Dad and his friend did a thing, and it mattered. Yeah. I'm a little verklempt here. Yeah, it was magic. It really, really was. And it was easy. It was easy. It was comfortable. It was fun. It was great. It was really, really, it was special. And I remember to make the slice behind the curtain a little bit bigger here, I remember how hesitant Brent Anderson was about coming on the show. And how he kind of do-si-do'd for a few weeks, where he's like, well, just send me some questions and I'll write you an email. And then finally, he's like, you know what? I'll come on. And that was a hell of a day. That was a good time. Really, really good time. And I owe all of it to you. So thank you for that. And thank you for everything you said, on and off the air. It means the world. It meant the world. It means the world. It always will mean the world. So thank you so, so much. But I think on that note, I should probably clear my throat and take this one home. Next time, of course, we're gonna head into the three-part detective story, which, it'll be all right. But of course, before we get out of here, we'll give the contact information. If anybody would like to join in on the conversation, I invite you to do so. You can find me all those different ways. Chris is on InfiniteEarths.com, WeirdComicsHistory@gmail.com, all the socials. I'm easy to find. But with all that said, and 50-some-odd minutes passed by, I want to thank you all so much for sharing some of your day with me today. And until next time, as always, I'll talk to you again real soon. See ya. Makes it harder to